On a very special in-person edition of the College Football Inquirer, we just got done watching a great national championship game. And oh my God, Indiana is the national champion of college football. Something that if I had told someone 10 years ago that this would happen, they would have probably had me committed. We talk about what Kurt Cignetti did to get the Hoosiers here and what it means for the rest of the sport. Because I think a lot of people are going to have some hope from now on because of the Hoosiers. Talk about it all on today's College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer. I am Andy Staples with Ross Dellinger and Stephen Godfrey, and we are all here in lovely Miami, Florida. It's very late, but this is where Kurt Cignetti is going to be sitting tomorrow, dispensing pearls of wisdom. Like not this room, like this spot. He'll be literally at this table.
Yeah, we're at the podium.
We just snuck in.
Yeah.
Security didn't seem to mind. So, yeah.
And a rare in-person.
Well, shout out to the folks who run the CFP media. They've actually been awesome this week. And they have left this room, because it's our work room as well, but they've left this press conference room with the professional lights on.
Yes.
So that any podcaster who needs to get in.
Yes.
Can do their pod.
This is actually like TV lighting right now. I'm tempted to put sunglasses on. It's very bright for 3 a.m.
So what do we think Kurt Cignetti is going to say tomorrow? We all were at his press conference tonight. Mm-hmm. And he drank a Hoosier beer. He's a happy camper. He said they're going to take Tuesday off and get back to it on Wednesday.
I know, one day off?
Yes.
One day off. It's so Saban, right? One day off. Everybody gets one day.
And then he contradicted himself, right? Because he had to worry about undergraduates. Like,
yes, tomorrow I'll be doing this. So.
Yeah. He's not taking a day off.
No day off. I'm guessing hopefully he will look back, because it's kind of hard after a game like that, especially that close, to like look back on what you've accomplished. So hopefully tomorrow we'll hear a little bit more in detail about the build here, which is, as you mentioned on the intro to the show, it's hard to believe.
Yes.
It's hard to believe that Indiana is the national champion in football. And it's hard to believe that we were in Miami and Indiana outnumbered Miami fans, Indiana fans, by 2-1, close to that.
At first I thought it was maybe 60-40 when we got to the stadium.
Yeah.
And then when you saw how many Indiana fans were left at the end, it was like, oh, no, there was more than that.
65-70%.
Yeah.
Most of the upper deck, too.
It was phenomenal. Yeah. And they were, instead of singing the... what is it? The one? What is the March Madness tune? The one final,
one shining moment.
One shining moment.
Yeah,
but it's fine if we're not a basketball podcast.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, I'm not a basketball guy. That's one shining moment. They were singing "We Are the Champions."
Well, they also played "Hurt So Good." You had to throw some John Cougar Mellencamp in there for Indiana.
I thought that was nice.
Yeah, it was amazing to watch, because one thing I loved about tonight before the game, everybody was so fired up. Everybody was so happy. And it was one of those things where all of us were talking before the game about, okay, why is that? And I think the answer is, for both these teams, this was not old hat. This is not Alabama, Ohio State, Georgia, where you're supposed to be here. This is, oh my God, we're here. This is so cool.
This was the purest I've ever seen, like a college football playoff, maybe championship game, or at least this far in, where the crowd was just so happy at the very beginning. No one was jaded. I've been here for, I think, 4 or 5 days now. I've been to multiple Indiana fan events, did other live podcasts. Everyone thinks, this is the one fallacy of the Indiana fan base that I've learned. They all think this is it. That was the mentality they came down here with. They were like, you know what? We've been to Atlanta. We went to the Rose Bowl. We're coming down here. We're maxing out the credit cards. But they all think that this was a one and done. And what's so funny is we're all sitting here talking about, like, this is a program that might be around for a while.
You might be back. Look, if Kurt Cignetti can take them from 3-9 to 11-2 to 16-0, I have no doubt that he can work his magic in the transfer portal and on the recruiting trail. Because remember, he recruited a lot of those JMU guys out of high school that he brought. I don't think this is it for them. I think they're going to be back quite a bit to this type of thing.
Yeah.
No, and that's the one comp. I know everybody feels like discombobulated because you're seeing Indiana on the helmet and they went undefeated And everybody dredged up that Sarkisian quote, Steve Sarkisian, the Texas.
Which, by the way, they're going to build these people
statues.
They are going to
build a statue.
He was right.
They're going to build a statue. What was the quote again for our listeners?
He said they ought to build a statue of that team because nobody's ever going undefeated again.
Yeah. No 16-0.
I think he specifically said, 16-0. Like, nobody's ever going to go 16-0. They have to build a statue. They are going to build a statue of Kurt Cignetti.
If you need to sort of like ground yourself as a traditional college football fan, in the modern era, with so many asterisks like Portal, NIL, it's not built like the Saban era, but they play like a Saban team. They look like a Saban team. Yeah. Like, they're, I really do think they look, I'm not saying they're going to repeat next year, but I really think they're going to be back.
Well, and they punished Miami for mistakes. Yeah. Even though, look, all credit to Miami, because they could have easily quit at halftime. It was 10-0. And I thought they kind of had tapped out at the end of the first half, because there was a 4th-and-2 on the 32-yard line of Indiana, which, and I realized the time was running out, but Miami still had 2 timeouts. Mario Cristobal, against every other team in America, goes for that 4th-and-2.
Yeah.
But they had just done a 4th-and-inches that they had barely gotten.
Right.
And Indiana was making them earn every single centimeter. And so they send the kicker out for a 50-yarder. They were 1 of 5 on field goal attempts from 40 yards plus in the playoff, guys. Like, I thought they were tapping out, and then they come out in the second half, get a stop, score a touchdown, and all of a sudden it is back and forth.
Well, and then they got Tony going, right?
Yeah.
The old baby Jesus, like, came out of nowhere and started running around the field like we're used to seeing all year, and that just kind of sort of sparked them and got them back in the game. And then that final drive, right, they got across midfield, maybe they were across midfield.
They had
40.
A chance.
They were 40 yards away, right? Yeah. They were 40 yards away from probably a national championship, and obviously, kind of a floater there that Carson Beck threw and intercepted. And
so
I was
the player who caught the interception is Glenn Sharp's son, right? The Miami player who was called for pass interference.
Oh,
against Ohio State in the national championship
game. God, that's right.
Really? Yeah.
I believe so. Fact check me, everybody, if I'm wrong on this, but that's incredible.
It's pretty wild.
Everything that happened is incredible, though.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
fact that they were there, it's one of those things that we've talked about it all year as we've watched them, but I'm still not sure we've acted amazed enough.
I know. It's still hard to wrap your mind around it. Like, right after the game, almost immediately, you know, you run out on the field, and I ran into Scott Dolson, the athletic director, and he was just, like, stumbling over his words. Yeah. He didn't know what to say, and speechless, and I can't believe this. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. He kept going on. This is a 5-year sort of march to this point when him and the president 5 years ago sort of said, all right, like, we want to be a valued member of the Big Ten. I've said the quote on the pod a few times.
Oh, yeah.
We want to be a valued member of the Big Ten, and we know we have to be good in football, and we know we have to invest. And they started doing that. And I think Kurt Cignetti in his press conference said, we have a president who's from the South. She was raised in Tennessee, Pamela Witten, and went to school at Tulane, got her a degree there. And, you know, they've been sort of building to this moment. And it's just kind of fitting that they beat a Southern team and Big Ten wins a third national championship.
It's really hard not to talk about that. It's really hard not to get into bigger context tonight. Everyone, like, look, it's a miracle. It's a wonderful Cinderella story. I'm still kind of shook by Indiana winning a national title, and it wasn't fluky.
Right.
Right. This wasn't some sort of gimmick offense.
They went 16-0 and really beat the crap out of most of the teams they played.
They were like humorless and Saban-esque, like we've talked about. That to me is more surprising than the logo on the helmet. But I was talking to a cluster of Big Ten officials on the other side of like the confetti cannons. And, you know, they were all aggressively saying, hey, don't quote me, but.
Of course. Yes.
Michigan and Ohio. But the gist of what we talked about was like Michigan, hey, we expect that. Ohio State, we expect that. This, for the Big Ten, feels like winning the lottery because this is the ascension of a program. You ask someone to come in behind those two schools for years and say, hey, we need an upper middle class that competes with the SEC. We didn't think it would be this program, but this is what they have.
Well, this would be like Mississippi State or Kentucky winning the national title in the SEC.
Yeah.
And that is, but, and so my On Three co-host, Ari Wasserman, brought this up tonight, and I thought it was really interesting. He's like, why shouldn't Minnesota or Mississippi State, or Texas Tech, or Kentucky? Like, why shouldn't they say, you know what? We can do this too. If they can do this, we can do this.
New landscape, right?
I think we talked about this like a week ago. I said, like, I really like the Will Stein hire. They're already starting to get aggressive. And everybody laughs about it. Guys, this is exactly what they were doing in Bloomington 2 years ago.
Yeah.
This has to feel good for that 30 to 40 odd, like, middle of the Power Four.
Yeah.
That for years, yeah, define their success as like, oh, you know what? We'll win 9. We'll have a solid year. We might go to like a Cotton Bowl or something like that. Anything is technically possible if you have a lot of money too.
If you invest, I mean, it was just funny because in the press conference, Kurt Cignetti said, "I got to get something out of the way,"
Man.
We don't have as much NIL money as everybody thinks we have, and I don't know like what he thinks everybody thinks, but we've talked about it in the pod before. Like they don't have like top five.
They've very NIL money necessarily, but the figure out. I think they're undershooting because they.
It
makes it more impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they've thrown out the $20 million figure. I wouldn't be shocked if they were in the $20 to $22 million range, which teams spent over 30 this year.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's plenty of teams that spent well over 25 or 30.
If it were to come to light 6 months from now, they spent 45.
Who cares?
Right. It doesn't matter.
National title.
Listen, right. 16-0 and kicking everybody's ass.
Their
too.
Center. Worth every penny.
Yes.
Whatever it was they paid him, it probably wasn't enough.
That's the thing. It's not just about the money, right? And we saw it in the game. They made big plays and moments, number one. Number two, they didn't shoot themselves in the foot much, and they didn't do that all year.
Right.
Discipline, very disciplined. And Andy, you said it, like, it felt like every yard Miami got was just so hard. And that's what reminded me most of the Saban teams is the discipline in that. But also one other thing, the best position group on the field may have been Miami's defensive front, line, but the second best certainly, like Indiana's secondary, holy cow. They made some unbelievable plays.
Back. And there was nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. And they just timed it perfectly. Like when they got ball got to hand and they made the hit perfectly. It was really impressive.
They didn't get called for pass interference at all. And I don't remember there being a situation where I thought it should have been called but wasn't. I felt like they just arrived at the right time.
It was remarkable.
Pretty much every time.
Yeah, it was nice that some of the no calls early didn't factor into the result of the game. Ultimately, we're not sitting here talking about it the same
Fernando
way.
Mendoza, should have been a targeting call.
We are leading with the crown.
Right.
We are launching.
Yeah,
we are doing this with intent. I mean, also, by the way, if Fernando Mendoza or any of his reps are listening, hey, bud, you don't need to take that block on.
Yeah.
You really don't need to engage. The thing that you noticed before he gets lit up is that
man was carrying out his fake Godfrey.
You just need to Olay that, man. Fernando that bull, okay?
Yeah.
Like, dude.
How about Alberto Mendoza? That's how they introduced him at the news conference. Mendoza.
How about them?
Just the Heisman winner, that's all.
How about them playing Fernando by ABBA?
Oh.
As he took the stage with the confetti flying. That was amazing.
Yeah, this was an
excellent
stuff.
Presentation.
There's so many great stories on this team from Fernando Mendoza, who is back in his hometown. By the way, that run, it's 4th and 12. They call it QB draw. So Pat Coogan told me they put that play in on Thursday and then maybe on Friday decided they are going to run it at some point if the time is right. But they did not run a draw all game.
Yeah,
They were confident in their draw game, but they were not. They just hadn't had
Miami
the right
kind of had it.
Yep.
And it really did.
He pinballed through like three tacklers.
It's not so much the scheme of the play.
Right.
It was just the
vision of him.
The dog in the fight, as we say. Or the fight in the dog, I should
say. Was it Holly Rowe who showed the picture of his arm just completely skinned?
Yeah.
And by the way, bruised. Like Coogan I talked to in the locker room is just covered in blood.
Yeah.
Like he has a white undershirt that's just covered in blood. So
credit to Miami. They made him earn it. There wasn't a lot, I think, like a massive amount of tactical error. I've talked all season, hey, we're waiting for the Mario Cristobal brain fart situation. They did, I think,
really
everything
they
could.
They had a punt blocked.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the only one I had before that,
catching the punt at the 4. Those two plays, back-to-back, those were the biggest gaffes.
Which I think had to have been an error on mine because Indiana was not in punt block formation, they said.
Correct. They only had two rushing.
Yeah. So. Kamara, who blocked it, is probably the Indiana story. That's what I led with in my Washington Post column. 0 stars, Ashburn, Virginia. A guy who just kind of quietly signs. It was the second recruiting class at JMU, right? Ascends, develops, magically earns 3 stars as a portal transfer, right? And that's what. And still,
he'd been productive.
That's the story, right? Is this a development culture for all of the things that people want to wave their finger at and demonize about this current state of college football, Indiana won a national title off of developing players. Now, yes, the methodology is basically complete opposite of what we saw Nick Saban, Alabama, you know, teams in the 90s.
There were some U-Hauls involved.
Yeah. And now they can,
what you got to do now.
They can land those big fish now, and we've seen in the portal, right?
But let's talk about the traditional part of it too. Godfrey, you mentioned the development part where, yes, they're developing players, some that they recruited out of high school. I would argue that the guys that they got out of the portal, they also made better. But they're also pretty good at the traditional kind of recruiting too, because look at what Charlie Becker did.
Yeah, it was remarkable. The back shoulder connection Charlie Becker and Fernando is just about as good as you can see. Man. Yeah, and with two huge third down plays that turn into first downs on those back shoulder catches, one would have right the final drive when they were going in.
It seemed early on like Miami, you mentioned this earlier, Miami wanted to be extra mindful of not giving them the mistake. It came on special teams eventually, and it swung the momentum of the game. But it also felt like Indiana saw something in the Ole Miss tape, and they did. They screened a lot. They wanted to get all of that athleticism and speed in the Miami defenders and put them in space.
Well, and Miami did not tackle as well in the open field as they did in the first two games of the playoff. They didn't really do it well against Ole Miss either. They did it really well against Texas A&M and Ohio State.
And I think that was something that Indiana saw in the prep, because it wasn't much of a Mendoza downfield, especially early on. There were a couple slants, a couple risky ones, but they really liked to get outside. They definitely saw something in Miami's defenders. They thought they could, again, take that tiny little thing in the margin, exploit it, and break them.
Well, and that's the thing. And Mario Cristobal actually talked about this on Saturday, because somebody had asked him about how they rebounded from their two losses. And one of the things he said was, we looked at ourselves and we said, we're working hard, but we're not getting the results we want. What are the reasons? And the reasons, he said, are in the margins. And I would say that Indiana worked better in the margins all year long than anybody. They just found more yards. They found more points.
Yeah.
And then.
Yeah. I mean, every time you look up, they're breaking a tackle.
Right? Yes.
That happens so many times.
There was a short dump off to Omar Cooper early in the game.
Yeah.
That's when I realized, oh man, Miami's in for a long night, because he's just grinding. His legs are churning. And that was a play that I remember just talking about it when I was at the Texas A&M game in College Station, where Miami would get those guys on the ground immediately.
Right.
Like that's a 2-yard gain. And Omar Cooper's grinding, and it's an 8-yard gain. And all of a sudden he's second and two, and you have all these options in the playbook.
I hate to keep coming back to it, but like the discipline, the precision, the technique, and the effort that team gives is just like I'm watching Alabama.
And
it really was.
Very boring play to play.
Yeah.
So look at the two defensive lines, for instance, right? Miami has... We're bloody in the lip, right? We got Mendoza. We're knocking the crap out of them early. They're breaking through. There's a lot of poor protection up front for any of you. Felt like, oh, okay, well, if there's a thing here that swings it for Miami, it's going to be just that pure raw athleticism of the defensive line. Indiana's D-line played really, really well.
Yeah.
When you pull the Fletcher touchdown run out, they're averaging, I think it was like 2.6
well,
a carry.
Well, the Fletcher touchdown run is not really on the defensive line because it's stretched out.
Yeah.
And there's a very great CJ Daniels block.
Yeah,
that turns it from a 6-yard gain to a 54-yard touchdown. And so, I mean, that they were and both lines of scrimmage seem to be very respectful of one another. The Indiana offense, I can't remember if it's Carter Smith or Pat Coogan said it was the best defensive line they'd ever played against.
Yeah. Yeah.
And look, there were some plays where Akeem Esidore was just all over. And Moten was Moten awesome.
Was good tonight,
Bane. Yeah. There's one play where Bane's getting held. And like I didn't even put this down as an Indiana mistake, because the right call was to hold Bane because he was going to kill Fernando Mendoza.
Sure,
it was worth the 10 yards.
Like a really long ball.
Yes, yeah. Like they're holding him and holding. And finally the guy throws the flag. And you're like, you had to hold there because he was going to be decapitated.
It's so rare to see the team win who didn't have the better defensive front, too. Like the most dominant defensive front, I feel like.
And they weren't the most dominant. They were still really good. It's just that, to go back, like every one of their position groups is so exceptional in the most boring way possible. But they don't have that outsized five-star, like, blow you away the way the Bama teams did. And so it's like a little bit of sleight of hand when you get done watching the game. You're like, they never looked explosive. They're bad for the social media era. there's not a lot of clips you can pull out with it, like Indiana's defensive play, and it's just all sound technique. And then the sum of the parts.
I don't know. There's a few. There's a few. Because I remember watching one in the Oregon game where one of their D tackles just blew up a guard into the offensive tackle who was trying to block the defensive end. And it set up a twist that led to a sack strip.
Get those plays, but every team in the playoff has those plays. Yeah. I think where they won this national championship are all those tiny, seemingly inconsequential other plays.
Yeah, again, the boring, the precision, back shoulder, nine-yard pass, and just the technique of some cornerback, arriving at the ball perfectly.
Yeah. Richard Sherman, I think, tweeted about the last interception, and he was talking about how perfectly fundamentally sound it was.
Yeah.
It's teach tape, basically.
Yeah. I was about to say, the thing I've heard the most DMing with coaches throughout this playoff is teach tape, teach tape, teach tape. Everything is correct on film.
And you got teased to our next segment, more Nick Saban talk about something he said on game day before the kickoff.
I love it. I love it. I want to hear this.
You should keep talking about this guy, even though he's retired. I love it.
Well, there's a documentary coming.
I heard about that.
6 hours, I can't wait.
But he also once did employ Kurt Cignetti, our hero, in this episode. Yeah. So, yes, let us talk about what Nick Saban said, and also the Kurt Cignetti of it all. I mentioned giving other teams hope.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't it just possible that Kurt Cignetti is now the best coach in college football?
Oh, wow.
We'll be right back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and if you want to see how we have commandeered the stage that Kurt Cignetti will be on, then you need to watch us on the Yahoo Sports Network, yahoosports.tv, on your phone, on your tablet, on your laptop, anywhere, day or night. Also, we are on probably your smart TV. You just turn it on. You'll look at the home screen. It'll have all those icons. Click on the Yahoo Sports Network, and you can watch the College Football Inquirer and see us in all of our glory. Russ has got an old-fashioned...
Yeah. Off camera.
That's well. He can put it on camera. It's fine. I was gonna bring one down.
Yeah, I know. But, I'm a little mad now, because I know we've discussed that we were gonna prop those, and then I didn't bring it down. Yeah,
I got an early start tomorrow.
Yes, so I don't. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
For those who, we are recording this at 3 a.m. Yep. So
it is 3:11 Eastern time.
So one correction: Jamari Sharp, who had the last interception, nephew of former Kane. Glenn Sharp.
We make mistakes. Who had the, Indiana.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Indiana does not make mistakes. We occasionally we have a slip up.
We're talented with mistakes. We're like Miami.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You teased us
a little earlier
with something that Nick Saban said on College Game Day.
Yeah, so moments before kickoff, the stage, the live production of Game Day is going on the field, I believe. He's about to, I think, give his prediction. But she ended up picking Miami.
He did.
Pat McAfee was the only one who picked Indiana.
Yeah, it was great. And Saban, I guess, he was talking about what to attribute to the Big Ten's latest success and dominance.
Oh boy, here we go.
College football. Yeah, he sort of used the loosening of the athlete compensation rules as a reasoning that the Big Ten is having success. Specifically, saying that. They're sort of coaxing Southern athletes down, north.
Why?
Well, there you go.
Why would they suddenly be able to get those guys?
But listen to this quote.
Okay.
He says all this, right? And he says, "You'll never convince me otherwise, because people in the South would not go to the North unless you paid them." Which is quite a comment.
As a Southerner, I agree with that.
Didn't he go to college at Kent State?
I mean, West Virginia is not really the South either.
No, but I mean, he spent enough time in Northeast.
He worked in Cleveland, for God's sake.
Come on, guy.
But that it just sort of builds to this SEC Southern arrogance talked about a lot.
It's funny that he's leaned into all the gross oversimplifications that he used to just absolutely crucify us for making.
Let's talk about this. Charlie Becker's from Nashville. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you think Charlie Becker would have gone to an SEC school if a bunch of SEC schools had offered him scholarships? Because I think he would have.
Fernando here.
Yeah.
Miami.
My rebuke among many is, what part of snowplow country is Dade County? Like, Miami made the national championship.
Right.
It's not limited. Yes, I do think the Big Ten might have a foothold in the free agency market better than they used to.
Yeah.
But we look.
Because they have highly engaged, large fan bases. They have money.
God knows we spent 20 years saying, yeah. Hey, you need to pay them under the table if you want to get better. And yes. A lot of Big Ten fan bases did not feel inclined to do that. That is true. We know that. But this idea that all of a sudden this current system can only benefit the Big Ten, I think is a fallacy.
No, SEC schools can do this too. And there are SEC schools that are trying. They're just not doing it as well, which brings me to my question, which is, we talked about, I mentioned earlier, you know, what should Minnesota feel? What should Kentucky feel? What should Mississippi State feel? What should Texas feel? Like, Kurt Cignetti has just coached circles around all of these coaches who probably had more expensive rosters. Most of them probably did. It still matters who your coach is.
If they had more expensive rosters, there's a couple places we can go with this. So 63, 64% of the snaps were transfer portal players,
right? Yeah.
According to that graph The Athletic put out.
Yep.
Second most of the playoff teams.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We think they're not spending Texas dollars or Ohio State dollars, right?
Right.
If we're believing what
But we know they're spending dollars.
Okay. Yeah. So there's a money ball element to this, one.
Yep.
We also know by virtue of players like Kamara tonight that they're identifying, developing, and hanging on to talent mm-hmm. and graduating them through this system.
They're retaining who they want to retain.
Okay. So that's an element too. So there's a little money ball to this.
Yep. They're old.
They're very experienced.
Yeah.
Although not appreciably older than Miami, by the way.
Right. Well, that's a whole other conversation we could have, and I think we will in the offseason on, are we just going to keep chasing veteran talent at certain positions?
Well, if you talk to a good mid-major basketball coach, what will he say? What would he always tell you?
That he wants experience?
Get old and stay old.
Right. Yeah. But get old and stay old used to apply to, you know, we're still putting these guys through a system of 4 years, right? Maybe we take some JUCOs, that kind of thing. I think what fans are a little scared of, and I think some of these programs are trying to solve for X, if you're Texas, right? The money's not the problem.
Right.
And high school recruiting is not the problem. If high school recruiting has been diminished, by what order of magnitude has it been diminished? A lot of people are talking about this, I think, tonight and tomorrow. This is Indiana.
Right.
If we are convinced that SIG and this program, they're going to be around for a while, we know they have to be better at high school recruiting.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'll take a Charlie Becker anytime.
But to your point,
Daniel Ndokwe,
can they cherry pick regionally? And is the idea of I'm sitting in a talent-rich state suddenly not as important?
It's definitely not as important.
Yeah.
Look, hey, LSU kind of answered this for us because they didn't hire somebody who kills in the high schools, right?
Right.
They went out and they a talent-rich state where one program is the priority said, we need a portal king.
Yeah.
So that, I think, might be the Cignetti lesson. Now, to go back to this, if I'm Texas, dude, that's against 40, 50 years of the blueprint.
Right. And now you got to figure things out. Because, and this is my question, if you're Texas, if you're Georgia, if you're Ohio State.
Okay.
Are you hurting yourself paying up front for top-end talent, paying to keep that top-end talent when it is not producing on the field for you? Because there is a development cost there. And then, or are you putting people out early, playing them maybe before you normally would because, one, you're paying them, and, two, you're not as deep because you're paying them.
Right.
And they are at risk of running into a 23-year-old who maybe wasn't as athletically gifted but just kicks their ass because he's a 23-year-old and they're 19.
It still feels double-edged, though, because you are going to have to pay a high dollar amount to take a 5-star out of high school. We know that, right?
What I think will happen,
okay,
is I think your Ohio States and your Texases are going to reserve more dollars for older players, which will probably send some of those 4-stars. The 5-stars are still going to go to the same schools they always went to. But some of those high 4-stars are going to go to some schools that we might not be used to seeing them go to.
So we're going to see a market correction both in the direction of the commitments, but also the dollar valuation on any high. It sounds like what you're leading us to is the dollar valuation on high school players will diminish to some degree in the coming years.
I would think so. And I also think we're going to see guys who normally would have been, and I think we're seeing it a little bit anyway, but guys who would have been the 20th guy in Alabama's class, now they're like, they'd be the first guy in Arkansas's class before.
Right.
They might be moving to like the fifth or sixth guy in Arkansas's class because they might be able to get a few of those guys.
I know one thing that we're not going to debate anymore is whether or not Carson Beck was worth $4 million. Mm. The quarterback market is going to stay hot. It's going to stay expensive. Yeah. It's going to stay silly for a little while.
Well that's and that's getting experience, right? You're talking about like getting older players at certain spots, like quarterback, left tackle, I don't know, you know, maybe even safety. Like you think about those middle linebacker, like those.
Miami's decided it is a transfer quarterback school. And that's another story that we need to talk about at some point. Maybe our next segment we will talk about that and where it goes from here, because there is a quarterback who has announced that he will enter the portal. I don't believe he's officially in the portal yet, that we suspect will wind up at Miami, and he is a veteran.
Yep. Yeah.
And so if you're Emory Williams, who's been waiting his turn at Miami, you probably, I mean, the portal opens for the Miami players now.
Right.
We'll see what happens. But the Cignetti part of it is interesting because it may just be that he's the best coach in America. It may be that we are looking at this and saying, oh, Minnesota has hope and Kentucky has hope.
Yeah.
And it may just be that, no. If you hire the greatest coach in America, you can win the national title.
Well, we keep attributing all this to like the recruiting, right, and just their methodology. But I keep going back to like the discipline and the technique and all that to the team. And if, you know, Oregon or Ohio State or Texas or Georgia had sort of this discipline and precision that we've seen in the technique that
with
we see
the talent
from Indiana,
that they have,
then they would be here too. So there's something to, having a great coach.
The most exciting part of this sport right now, especially in our line of work, we don't know. We're in a massive discovery phase, and there are so many fundamentals, pillars of the sport, right? Personnel, this, finance, et cetera. And they've all changed all at once. And I feel like I say this all the time, but we don't have enough data. It's only been 2 years of this, and it's only been 4 years of this. We may not know why this happened, why we're sitting here talking about an undefeated national team champion Indiana correctly for a couple more years.
True.
So I still want to give Kentucky and Minnesota some hope, though.
I don't mind doing that. I'm very excited to see what Will Stein does. PJ Fleck, we kind of know what he does. Do some of these longstanding coaches look at what has happened and say, you know what? There are things I can do differently that might be more like what Cignetti did.
Or is it a comet hitting the dinosaurs?
Could be. And that is, but that's the strangest thing because Kurt Cignetti is a 64-year-old who, and he had a great answer to a question Matt Fortuna asked at the end of the press conference. And basically, why did you gamble on yourself? Why did you take a D2 head coaching job? And he was explaining his whole history. He went through basically his whole Wikipedia page where, you know, he was an assistant at Rice and they weren't good. He was assistant at Pitt and they weren't good. And then he gets to NC State and they are good. And so Nick Saban hires him. But he was closing in on 50 years old. He wasn't a coordinator yet. Nobody was looking at him for head coaching jobs. So he took the head coaching job he could get at Indiana University of Pennsylvania.
And Nick Saban told him, don't do that.
Yeah, well, it's crazy. But he was behind, you know, that was the time, I think Jim McElwain was the offensive coordinator, Kirby Smart was the defensive coordinator, but you go, you know, McElwain, Nussmeier, like, would Kurt Cignetti have been their OC at some point? Don't know.
He was older
potentially,
than
potentially,
because basically,
he was
Nick,
older. He was
Nick, remember, Nick hired Major Applewhite first, went very young.
Yeah.
But Nick kept hiring younger guys. And so if you're Kurt Cignetti, you're looking at that and reading the tea leaves and going, I may be, and he talked about this because his dad, obviously, Frank Cignetti, Hall of Fame college football coach. And Kurt Cignetti talked tonight about seeing those 60-year-old career assistants later in life and thinking, I don't want to be that.
It still doesn't make sense, though.
No, it doesn't. University of Pennsylvania. A school that can't even have the name of its own state in it.
Romantic as hell, because it paid off, and we're sitting here talking about it in the wake of a national championship. But to think, could he have been next in line behind this OC? How many jobs came off of being a Bama assistant? Or once you even got the coordinator title? Right. He probably should have done that. He probably could have ended up maybe in the Mountain West first.
Think of all the Saban assistants who were hired with the hope that they would create something that looked like what Nick Saban did.
Yes. This is what I'm getting at.
Jeremy Pruitt.
Derek Dooley. Will Muschamp.
I mean, so all of these guys, and you know, like, Will Muschamp got multiple SEC jobs.
But here's the thing about serendipity. If he does that and he's the next one on that conveyor belt, think about how many of those jobs they fed those guys into with Saban expectations, where the apparatus of school X, when the guy leaves Bama, well, they can't create what Bama was doing for Saban. So Cignetti takes the makes the low odds choice and goes off basically into the hinterlands for like, what, a decade or two, and then hits the sport at just the right moment. And keep in mind, like, I wouldn't call JMU a distress job by any measure. In fact, I think they were really mindful in how they transitioned up to FBS. Nobody wanted Indiana.
He took the power conference job that nobody actually wanted.
Nobody wanted that job.
Well, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about that probably gets a little overshadowed is all the guys that like base group that he brought over from JMU. They sort of like knew his style. And I remember visiting there last year, and they all sort of like everybody that stayed at Indiana that were the previous Tom Allen's players. I think that group at JMU helped so much of just getting everybody else on board with how it's going to be with Coach Cignetti.
That will be a historical precedent.
Yeah.
We've talked about it with five or six other schools now, like Charles Huff's doing it for the second time in 2 years.
Matt Campbell is currently doing it at Penn State. Yeah. Alex Golish is currently doing it at Auburn.
Yeah.
And I think it's funny because Auburn's a really interesting one because their AD was seemingly obsessed during the coaching search with keeping their roster
together. Yeah.
When really, you wanted Golish to bring in the best parts of his USF team.
Yes.
You want Matt Campbell to bring in the best parts of his Iowa State team.
We can talk about Auburn later, but I think the early trend that's being copied from the Cignetti experience is specifically, oh man, to hell with year zero or even half of year one. If I've got 12 to 14, I feel like that's the good big number.
Nucleus.
And some on both sides of the ball. I'm skipping ahead maybe days and weeks in terms of spring ball, in terms of not so much like installation, but you said it earlier, it really is culture. It's a cliche we talk about, but having that many guys come in jumps you ahead. Well,
Carter Smith, the left tackle for Indiana, who was signed by Tom Allen and was there, has been there his whole career. He said there were guys that would just not be ready for practice. They'd just kind of blow everything off. As soon as the Cignetti guys got there, as soon as those JMU guys got there, the Aiden Fishers and the Mikhail Kamaras, as soon as they got there, it was like, no, that's not how we do it.
Right.
You're either going to do it the way we do it or they'll find somebody else.
So contrast that with everything that we knew in the sport up until this point, which was you would have a coaching staff screaming at a roster they inherited that they didn't fit with culturally, and that's where the concept of year zero and year one started.
Quick story about Cignetti that I think when he was at JMU sort of paints a good picture of who he is and why their team is the way they are. It was shared with me by one of his assistants. They were at JMU, and their best defensive player was like 5 minutes late for a meeting, and it was like another strike against this player. And he was the best guy on their unit. And Cignetti told him to leave. Like, that was it. Told him to leave.
No favorites.
Gone.
It's not the Lawrence Taylor story.
And I think, I think one of the assistants was like, yo, coach, this is our best guy. We're just getting here to build the program. He's like, he's out.
That is the equivalent. That's the coaching equivalent of what they say the first day in prison, walk up to the top of the
shank
of
an example.
An example for everybody.
One thing I'm curious, because we've been kind of trapped in this loop of playoffs and media days for like the last couple of weeks, and we've heard the same stories 100 times. I was at AFCA. You were there.
Mm-hmm.
Talked to a lot of coaches. Very quietly, conversations are saying, hey, if we want to imitate something from Cignetti, there's a lot of talk about this health to practice time thing that he's instituted, as well as, God forbid, a little bit of an improvement in quality of life for coaches, which is if you show up and execute and we have an incredibly well-organized day, you don't need to be here until 2 a.m.
Every night. That's actually not new.
No, I know. There's several
coaches. Steve Spurrier did that. Bob Stoops did that.
But guess who didn't? Nick Saban did that.
Yeah,
and then, all of a sudden for 15 years, everybody had to be at the office 23 hours a day.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fun to watch this. And it'll be interesting because one thing Kurt Cianni has not had to do yet is replace key assistants. Mm-hmm. Mike Shanahan, his offensive coordinator, is still there. Brian Haynes, his defensive coordinator, is still there. The only one they lost was last year. They lost Tino Sinceri, who went to UCLA. And UCLA thinks they're getting the offense. Well, they didn't even get the coordinator or the – it's Cignetti's offense. Let's be real here.
Well, some of that was, I think, a poor decision on you. That UCLA staff wasn't.
And then Shanahan calls it. Yeah. So they have all of that still together. It reminds me a little bit of when Urban Meyer was at Florida, where he kept, I think he didn't lose a single assistant for the first 3 years. And that continuity was pretty important. And that's what was one of Nick Saban's superpowers, if you look back. Actually being able to replace coordinator after coordinator and still being able to be at a high level.
And a lot of times not promoting from within, actually.
Right.
Going out and
finding somebody. Like Pete Golding coming from UTSA, and I know the Alabama fans wanted to run him off, but...
Oh, God, yeah.
I think it's worked. Pete Golding's proved himself to be a pretty good coach.
He's done okay.
So,
the idea of all the stuff that in the Saban mythos is overplayed, the idea of taking someone, usually an ex-head coach, coming in as a coordinator and saying, hey, welcome to day one. This is our terminology. This is our culture.
You'll learn it.
That hasn't been tested in Cignetti yet. Although, again, I go back to talk, kind of gossiping with those coaches at the convention. Quality of life's really high. Maybe we're going to see a Clemson situation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Clemson a couple years ago was different. They were just paying their coordinators exceptionally well. So it was really hard to take the G5 job or even the lower power jobs.
Right.
You know, that's why Morris and Venable stuck around for so long.
Well, and right now you're in a cycle where they wanted sitting head coaches. I think it's going to boomerang back to where they want coordinators. Although, I do think they might want old coaches next time around.
Okay.
So
if there's a trend of just hiring.
Willie Fritz is going to be at the top of the dance card.
We've been saying this all year.
Another
thing we've been saying all year is we don't have a tree yet. We don't have a tree yet. We've talked about maybe the Lanning tree is it. If this is the tree and we're a year off from that, that could be the next huge trend in coaching. And it's why we've hired so many sitting head coaches in the meantime.
We will see what happens with that. But right now, barring one of the college coaches getting an NFL job, which does not seem likely, I don't think they're going to lose any coordinators. I don't think they're going to lose anybody really important to them. And we are going to see fairly intact coaching staff next year for Indiana, which will be... And this is what I'm fascinated is because there is a very good core of players that they will...
talented quarterback too coming in from the portal.
Right, Joshua's coming in from TCU, but... You know, probably losing D'Angelo Pons, probably losing Elijah Surratt, probably, these are important players. Mikhail Kamara, Aiden Fisher, really important players. So they're going to have to replace them. If you look at their portal class, it looks like they have found a bunch of highly productive people.
Again, that might be the secret sauce.
What's going to be interesting, too, is we just talked about the nucleus you brought from JMU. Yeah, a lot of those guys are going to be gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, I do think there's enough players... Now that I understand,
like
Charlie Becker, who will be a junior next year, can stand up and be like, "This is how we did things when we won the national title."
Well, now it's championship standard.
Now it's different.
Like literally internally, when that first roster meeting happens for the 2016 team, the standard we know what the results are. There's no questioning what happens here.
Yeah.
Yep. When we come back, there is another story related to one of the teams playing the national title game, but it is in the portal, and then it involves 2026. Let's talk about that when we come back. We are back at the College Football Inquirer, and we have talked a lot about the national championship game. One of the stories that was kind of hanging over the national championship game involves Miami, we think, but is...
We're pretty certain, Andy.
But it's a 2026 season situation. So, Ross, early in the week, it was Friday actually, word comes down that Duke quarterback Darian Mensah plans to enter the transfer portal. And it very quickly becomes obvious that the potential destination is Miami. Darian Mensah very famously left Tulane to go to Duke. We think he was making $4 million a year at Duke. He was on a deal. I suspect there will be a fight for this.
Yeah, he was on entering the second year of a two-year deal that roughly paid him $4 million annually. I spent some time there in August with him and Manny Diaz and interviewed his mom and did this big story on how he's basically came from sort of nothing and became the highest paid or one of the highest paid college football players. And he seems like he's now going to be the highest paid college football players if everything works out, it sounds like, with Miami. So what's happening right now is when you're listening to this, it may be old news, but he will either Tuesday or Wednesday be entered into the portal.
Or not.
By Duke.
Maybe.
Well, I think
there will be a lawsuit if he's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two avenues here to kind of resolve the fact that he's under contract. Right, one avenue is sort of an arbitration legal side, and then another one is just a financial settlement that you know Miami strikes, because there's no stated buyout in the contract, but Duke owns his NIL, not exclusively, but prohibits another university from using his NIL rights. So, like somebody said to me, half jokingly, maybe, that if they don't let him out, if there's not a financial settlement, that he can play for Miami and he'll just have to play in a Duke uniform.
That would be funny.
Would be funny.
Well,
not the state of college athletics off the field.
No buyout.
There could be a financial settlement.
Right. No, but there's no figure in the contract.
No, and Duke could say, like, you know what? We don't want a financial settlement. We're not releasing him, plain and simple. And there's an arbitration path if that happens.
You go back to the DeMond Williams situation in Washington, and DeMond Williams ultimately decided to stay at Washington. Washington did set a damages figure at $4 million, which was the amount they were going to pay him. The thing I find fascinating about this, because, you know, we've covered a lot of coaches leaving, and there are different tricks that the school uses. Well, trick is not the right word. Different methodologies the school uses when they hire a coach who's at another school and they have to pay his buyout. Remember, you are actually taxed for that as the person, because the person owes the buyout. The school doesn't own the buyout.
Right.
And so sometimes the school will buy the contract from the other school, and that way they do not have to compensate the coach to pass it through. Mm-hmm. But in this case, where it is not going to be a, you know, sunshine and lollipops, everybody gets along situation, let's say Duke did set a buyout and say, okay, we are willing to take $4 million.
Yeah.
If Miami pays $4 million and then pays Darian Mensa $6 million in salary, Darian Mensa will be taxed on $10 million, even though he's only getting $6 million.
And then Miami will have its next year's rev share reduced by the buyout, the $4 million.
Correct, because you can't guarantee NIL funding for that.
So we're talking about a lot of money, in which is what sort of scared away a little bit, you know, when we talk about the LSU DeMond Williams situation. It's $4 million reduction in buyout, which you're paying him a new salary, and all that sort of adds up, and it de-incentivizes what we
just put him on loan. This entire segment,
a soccer team.
I've listened to both of you this entire segment, and I'm like, oh god, every day is a step closer to European soccer for college football.
This probably is.
Just loan his ass out for $10 million.
here's the thing about this, though. It's not as much the what happened. If this had happened a week earlier, Duke would have been mad. It would have sucked, but Duke doesn't have an opportunity to get anybody else at that point. The portal closed on Friday. So Duke, I think, knew rumblings of this on Thursday. And so maybe but the thing is, the only thing you can do at that point is tamper.
Right.
And if you're Duke and you're about to sue Miami, or you're going to threaten suing Miami, you probably shouldn't be engaged in tampering if you're going to do that.
By the way, Miami could be sued now twice within the year for tortious interference.
Wisconsin.
They are going to start, I would guess, this spring. They're going to start
discovery. There's a telephonic status conference set for March 16th. I did look it up the other day.
I would expect some people are going to be interviewed at the University of Miami about what happened.
Something tells me they're not that worried.
No, they don't seem to be worried since they're going down a similar alley here.
If anything, the reaction seems to be, oh, cool,
let's tie this together with another story I had this past weekend. Is Miami's sitting athletic director said he thinks the cap should be totally lifted and everybody should be able to pay whatever they want to pay because enforcement is too difficult. And I think given Miami's actions, they realize that enforcement probably isn't happening, or they assume enforcement is not happening.
And enforcement is probably impossible because if you enforce, you're probably going to get sued. And you probably don't have a legal leg to stand on because, again, the house settlement is a settlement. It is not. It was not a case that reached its end with a judgment,
a ruling, of some sort. So and now, you know, a week ago or so, last Tuesday at the NCAA convention in D.C., Brian Seeley of the College Sports Commission, the enforcement arm, held sort of an hour-long presentation in front of administrators and some very small group of media there. And, you know, he announced that they sent letters of basically inquiry or emails or calls to certain schools. So the, quote, enforcement, at least the first step of it has started, maybe. We'll see where that goes.
Yeah.
Want to back up real fast?
Sound sold, Andy.
Yeah. One letter that goes to the state of Tennessee and all of a sudden the AG is going to blow it up. So just wait. Yeah.
Want to back up real fast. The portal closes. Mensa, just so we can be clear here. Mensa enters in right as it closes, correct?
He's not in the portal yet.
Right.
He is, but if the portal closes. Right. Requested it that morning.
Yes.
Okay. Right,
Friday morning.
Yeah. So then he could still technically sort of slide in.
He's going to,
right.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Right. You could put him in at 48 hours.
The transfer portal is just a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Right. All it does is tell the schools you are allowed to contact this person.
Right. But we know how much context going on outside of the portal.
I think it was the Yahoo social team on media day. They're walking around. It was the best dumb question I heard asked was, if the transfer portal made a sound, what would it be? And then most of the kids are just like, cha-ching.
I like it.
That's where we're at.
I think it's, you remember at the bank when you use the drive-up teller and you put the tube in it? I feel like that's the sound.
Pneumatic
sound. Yeah, I think that's the sound.
How about this?
No, that's the sound that we all made as we staked out the college football playoff meeting.
Ah, yes.
Ross and I will be back on Thursday to talk about what comes next for the college football playoff after lots and lots of meetings. And there's a deadline on Friday, by the way.
Here's the tease.
God, what a tough show for me to miss.
Cocker's going to be on vacation.
So. I believe I'm going to miss that one.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. What a hell of a season.
Yep.
But the College Football Inquirer does not stop. Just because the season's over doesn't mean we stop. Every Tuesday and Thursday, we will be here with you. So Ross and I will be back talking about whatever comes next for the college football.
Yeah.
We'll all be back, next Tuesday?
Absolutely.
Yep. The playoff will be 36 teams. I'm very excited.
That's right. Yeah.
We will talk to you soon.